Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the premiere edition of Each for All, the Cooperative Connection. We are a program sponsored by the British Columbia Institute for Cooperative Studies. The BCICS is a research institute located within the University of Victoria in BC, Canada. My name is Robin Puga, and I work at the British Columbia Institute for Co-op Studies. My co-host is Eric Martin.
And I also work at the BC Institute for Cooperative Studies, and I'm a history student here at the university.
And we're broadcasting on CFUV, Campus and Community Radio. That's 101.9 FM in Victoria, cfuv.uvic.ca, live on the internet. And you can also listen to our show off our website, bcics.uvic.ca/radio. This is Each for All.
Each for All, the Cooperative Connection.
The Cooperative Connection.
Each for All, the Cooperative Connection.
Each for All, the Cooperative Connection.
So a bunch of people get together and work together to make money for everybody, to make things happen for everybody.
Each for All, the Cooperative Connection.
Each for All, the Cooperative Connection.
Welcome back to Each for All. Today we seek to answer the question on everybody's mind, what is a cooperative and where did this all start? First, our team of adventurous reporters visits the campus watering hole, seeking answers to important questions in our segment, Word on the Street. Then we present the first of a two-part series, including a discussion with Dr. Ian McPherson, director of the BC Institute for Cooperative Studies, to discuss the origins of the cooperative movement and its historical context. Following the interview, we have the Cooperative Community Bulletin, and stay tuned for Each for All quiz question for a chance to win a BCICS prize package that includes a book on book of your choice on cooperatives.
Thanks, Eric. And now let's check in with our adventurous reporters, Christopher Luft, my co-host Eric Martin, and myself, Ram Puga. And we recently visited the closest gathering place to the BCICS. That's the Student Union Building here on campus. And we're asking people those important questions about what is a cooperative and seeing what they know about the cooperative model.
Okay, so we're doing a show on cooperative, like cooperative theory and history and that sort of thing.
Okay.
Have you guys heard of cooperatives before, cooperative organizations?
No, I haven't.
Not yet? Right on, that's cool. Right on.
Okay, so do you guys know what a cooperative is?
Not exactly.
So, have you heard of like MLC or co-op gas stations and stuff like that? So you know they exist. How do you think they run differently than regular businesses?
Concern.
So, have you heard of cooperatives before, like cooperative organizations?
No.
No? Okay. So, have you heard like MEC, M-E-C, or Co-op Store, anything like that?
No.
Okay, well, thanks, so. Okay,
do you know what a cooperative is?
Like a cooperative education program?
No, like a cooperative is a business model or...
No.
No? Okay. Well, that's...
do you know... What a co-op is?
I should, since my dad was the vice president of Mountain Co-op.
Well, I should hope so.
Okay, so have you heard of a cooperative before?
No.
No?
No. Like cooperative vendors.
Like co-op gas station.
Yeah, oh, well, no. Yeah, I've heard of that. I thought you meant it was the name of the radio station. Yeah, I've heard of cooperative.
No.
I took
industry
to
cooperative. Oh, wow. Good for you.
Yeah.
So how do you think a cooperative is different from a regular business? I imagine you probably have a pretty good idea.
Well, I think that
she answered it pretty well.
So we're doing a show on cooperatives.
Okay.
Have you heard of cooperatives at all? Like cooperative association?
I took the class here.
Oh yeah, really?
With Ian
McPherson?
Yeah.
Right on, cool. Well, can you give me maybe a couple of examples of cooperatives you can think of?
Now I'm looking at co-op.
Right on.
There's like spicy pizzas or...
Yeah.
There are cooperatives too, right?
Right on.
I know a bunch of kids who just, like, I guess it's not really a cooperative, but I know a bunch of dumpster divers who get together once a week and make a massive meal.
Oh, yeah.
Sort of like a form of cooperation, I guess.
Right. So do they organize, like you get together and pick up boxes they do? Or?
No, it's just like everybody arrives on the same day and then everyone contributes, you know?
Oh, yeah. Right on. So, just as far as, like, we'll take Matt, because most people know about Matt, right? Can you maybe explain what the difference is between Mac as like a store as opposed to like a normal? Like,
well, Mac isn't a workers cooperative,
yeah.
It's a consumer co-op,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so you pay in like, what is it, like $7 or $5 or something, and then you're supposed to get like some sort of, I guess,
rebate.
Yeah. I've never gotten a rebate from them.
Yeah.
But I guess the rebate is going to like the Canadian government who invests a ton of money there every year.
Yeah.
And
sometimes it just gets absorbed into the price. Like,
yeah.
The price.
And like the sort of the upward cost of running new places and starting new stores. But I've always found that like, the service at places like cooperatives like Mac have just been a ton better than the service at any of these other places, right? Number one, because I think they have enough money to hire like informed employees and a lot of informed employees. And number two, because I think there's that level of actual care going on too.
Right on, man.
So that was our first installment of Word on the Street. Our upcoming installment of Word on the Street, we visit the May 1st event that just happened here. It was the Greater Victoria Cooperative Forum. This is an event sponsored by the British Columbia Institute for Co-op Studies and several other local community organizations, gathering people together to discuss the cooperative movement in Victoria, BC here. And we had about 50 people attending, and we'll have a little bit of audio from that next week. So now we plan on asking somebody with a little bit more experience about the cooperative movement. This is Dr. Ian McPherson, director of the British Columbia Institute for Cooperative Studies. He's no stranger to the cooperative movement. He's written countless books on the Canadian and international cooperative movement, served on many boards of cooperatives for 25 years or more, both at the provincial, national, and international level. He's the founding president of the Canadian Cooperative Association, chaired the process, and helped write the identity principles for the International Cooperative Alliance, the ICA. And in 2005, he received the Rochdale Pioneer Award, the highest award in the international cooperative movement. Although now he's technically retired, he still works harder than anybody I know. And here we have a first of a two-part interview with Dr. Ian McPherson and Eric Martin, my co-host here. This was recorded at the British Columbia Institute for Cooperative Studies. And here we go, Dr. Ian McPherson and Eric Martin.
So maybe we could just start off with the basic concept of what a cooperative is.
Okay. A cooperative is a legally constituted entity. In other words, the members organize a cooperative and then register with the government, and it's usually under a specific piece of cooperative legislation. It might be credit union legislation. In many jurisdictions, the two are separated because the credit unions have a different set of responsibilities in terms of protecting the funds that are invested.
Mm-hmm.
But the essence of it is that you register under a specific company and you create bylaws to govern your operations. And in between the registration process and the bylaws, you conform to the organizational directions of the ICA Statement of Identity.
Okay. And the ICA is the
International Cooperative Alliance. So what that really refers to is one person, one vote. That's what makes them different from a private capitalist firm. You vote as a person and not as an investor with a vote for each share. That's one difference. The other difference is that the return on capital is usually an interest basis. It's not a speculative return. So if you invest in a cooperative, you can expect a return, but it will be a return within limits. Another feature of a cooperative is that they typically have bylaw rules about their association with co-ops in their sector. So they usually are associated with them in that way. There are various dimensions of cooperativeness, but those are kind of the most important, and without which you can't really be a cooperative.
Right, so those are usually referred to as the cooperative principles, then?
That's right, yeah.
Okay.
So to put this in a historical context then, when do cooperatives emerge first as an important or a viable social movement?
Well, it's a movement. It's harder to pin it down in the sense that, you know, all societies, all civilizations, cultures have strong cooperative overtones. They differ significantly. So it's a movement, you can say, that in, say, the North Atlantic world, you can associate them with the beginnings in the Middle Ages, really. But the normal the starting point is with the onslaught of industrialization and urbanization in the late 18th, early 19th centuries. And they emerged simultaneous pretty well in many countries, so no single country can claim to be the great homeland of cooperative activities.
Right.
However, the co-op organization that set the standard for, in many ways, was in England, and it's the Equitable Society of Pioneers in Rochdale, a consumer cooperative organized in 1944, which define the principles, and there's more to the principles than I indicated. Those were just the more obvious ones. They define the principles on which cooperatives in varying degrees have been based ever since.
What were then, if we want to go on Rochdale for a minute or two, which is usually comes up at some point, what were the sort of practical factors that influenced the development in Rochdale?
Well, I think the main things were that it was a community that was under a lot of pressure and stress in the 1840s, and there were a lot of social and economic problems, and so the cooperatives were a part of really a range of responses to those problems. So the rules they put together talked about one person, one vote. They talked about not paying capital too much. They talked about returning on the basis of participation, which is another major rule within the cooperatives. In other words, the more you buy, the more you get back, usually expressed in a percentage term. Or in the case of other co-ops, the more you produce and sell through the co-op, the more you get back, again, usually expressed in a percentage terms, sometimes linked to the quality of what you sell through a cooperative too. So the practical things were there was a small city, industrial city, in the throes of great change in the region. We had a lot of ideas, a ferment of ideologies. Some notable political leaders of the period, for example, John Bright came from that area. And so it was a hotbed of ideas, and it should not be forgotten that just down the road, Engels also lived, which again suggests the intellectual ferment in the Black Country or industrial England, Manchester and the region around it. Rochdale is only a few miles from Manchester.
So was it essentially a working class reaction?
Yes, it was, and I would say they were. Maybe aristocracy isn't the word, but they weren't run-of-the-mill workers either. They were people with a range of education and training, and certainly engagement in educational activities and mechanics institutes, and in the development of the Chartist movement, which was one of the at the time seemed very radical, but in effect was arguing just for more or less the basic voting rights that we enjoy today. They were also active in various religious or political organizations, notably the Unitarian Church, where they attended, and which was also a location for a lot of what you would call political economy discussion.
Right. Maybe shifting focus, you mentioned just briefly that no one country has a claim to this, and that some of these movements are emerging at the same time. So maybe in the continent, are there other places in Germany or Italy, Spain, other countries that are around the same time as Rochdale, a little bit later, earlier?
If you take a period, say, 1840 to 1870, there are very few countries in which there aren't some stirrings of one type or another. And it's partly just the flow of ideas. This is a time of communication, change, and movement of peoples. So that's to be expected. There's a tendency to concentrate on certain types of co-ops in different countries.
In Germany, the most pronounced was in the financial bank, in the banking world, cooperative banking. Our version of those is credit unions, or Caisse Populaire in Quebec, which you can trace directly back into that period. And in France, it tended to be the kind of cooperative that was particularly stressed was worker cooperatives in the revolution of 1848, and in fact throughout the 1840s, and national workshops. And that tradition remained very strong in France right down to the present day. In Denmark, in the wake of the war with Prussia, the Danish economy was reoriented, restructured, and a significant part of that was the use of cooperatives in the countryside, especially for livestock and dairy products. Italy kind of borrows from everywhere, a little bit later, perhaps, for the most part. But you can go again. You can go to other places, too. Russia, not too long after, the Baltic countries, Sweden, they all become involved in types of cooperatives. Important thing to realize is that they also are not so much responding to the spread of a germ called cooperation as they see an institutional form they can graft onto their own, what one might call social economy organizations and instincts. Group activities to deal with the pressures of family life or community change.
Right. So, in the differences then, say in Germany, and they develop credit to help support the agricultural economy, which is particularly big in Germany, and France, the small producers, so they develop worker cooperatives. So, it's the cooperative organizations that develop are directly linked to major sectors that those countries excel in as far as production?
Yeah, actually that's something I was just writing about. A lot of these early co-ops emerge across classes is maybe one way of understanding it, but it gets a little complicated in rural areas. But across jobs and across large segments of the economy, as opposed to being little niche activities, which we might be more familiar with thinking about today. So you had large segments of the population fairly quickly involved, and the networks that help create those are important. They might be political, they might be religious, they might be ethnic even, but there is a kind of broad, these co-ops in the 19th century very quickly became broad-based movements. A bit of a difference maybe from how we might think about co-ops developing today. And that also helps to explain why they could grow relatively quickly and become significant forces in their country, whether it's in agriculture in Denmark. You know, the cooperatives grew very rapidly to become a major force in, for example, the livestock industry. And in France, too, in the national workshops movements associated with the revolution in 1848, and then again in the 1870 backlash to the Franco-Prussian War. So, what they left behind in that case, it is clearly a working class kind of connections, and if you like, typical or some of the common class analyses can be very useful in understanding that one. The credit cooperatives span what we would normally think of as classes. Everything except maybe the wealthy are included, and that was deliberately so. One of the themes that comes out of cooperative activism, whether it's in the United Kingdom or elsewhere, in the 19th century, is a desire to bridge classes, not so much to become a part of a class warfare. And that, despite the fact they tended to be associated with working class groups, but there was always this promise of avoiding the class warfare, which many people realized was a problem in the time. And of course, if you're for Karl Marx, you saw in that the wave of the future. But it was a distinguishing characteristic of most cooperative activity that they sought to bridge difference in class divisions.
So then as far as that specific ideological goal of say, bridging class, for example, where do these ideas start to emerge out of? Is it sort of a more spontaneous, from the top up, sort of general consensus, a collective ideological consensus, or are there specific channels which these ideas about cooperation are coming from?
I think that's a question that probably needs some young historian to look at more carefully. Clearly, it is a part of a working class culture in some parts of Europe, and by extension into the places that the European countries settled, like Canada, the United States. So you can see within working class movements, and you can see in some working class leaders the channels through which these ideas developed. The other thing, though, that I think is important is that early on, most of the national co-op movements, and especially the British movement, accepted some responsibility for the propagation of the message and the articulation of the cooperative philosophy. And I think you can make a case that it was a more complete and compelling philosophy than one can readily find today. It had tried to address various issues, and I think to some extent, well, clearly it did so in institutional forms because the cooperative movement grew. Whether it's a body of ideas, it did very well is another question, and I think the honest answer has to be that it didn't fare that well. That cooperativism, in comparison with liberalism or the very brands of conservatism, Marxism, anarchism, it was always rather amorphous. I think there's several reasons for that. One of them is that practice and ideology were often approached at the same time, and that's a very hard thing to do. It tends to be that the pragmatists take over, perhaps. And you could see that in the UK, I think, with what happened in the CWS, Co-op Wholesale Society. Pragmatists take over, that's one thing. But the second thing is that there never really was a compelling philosopher, if you like, of cooperativism in the 19th century. There were a few who did some really fine work and were certainly earnest to try, but I don't think it can be in comparison to the other ideologies of the age. It never was as complete and nor as exciting, I suppose, really. You know, you could get quite excited as an anarchist or a Marxist, or maybe even as a liberal, in terms of reorienting society and change. Cooperativism isn't that way. It wasn't that way either. And so, as an ideology, it certainly had a broad appeal and you can to this day hear echoes of it around the world from the 19th century and restatements of it in the context of our time. But it's an ideological system. It really needs to be explored much more deeply. And I think what one will find is that it's not so much philosophy as my colleagues in the philosophy department understand it, but as a history of ideas and how they are expressed and where they fit in within societies, that would be interesting. It needs to be looked at much more, and I think it's one of the great deficiencies in the field of cooperative studies that it hasn't been treated with the respect and diligence it deserves.
That was Ian McPherson discussing the material and the ideological origins of cooperatives and cooperativism. He discussed the beginnings of cooperative social movements at the national level in Europe, as well as the international level through institutions such as the International Cooperative Alliance, and he also touched on the development of general guidelines for cooperative organizations.
So as we mentioned, Ian was instrumental in helping draft the 7 principles of cooperative identity that was adopted by the International Cooperative Alliance, or the ICA. These cooperative principles are basically guidelines by which cooperatives can run, and they put their values into practice through these guidelines. They will be a reoccurring theme on this show. The principles really encapsulate the difference between the co-op model and other forms of business organizations. So since it is going to be a reoccurring theme, we thought we might just quickly list off the 7 principles here, and I'll start with the first one. The first principle is voluntary and open membership.
Second principle is democratic member control.
The third principle is member economic participation.
Fourth principle is autonomy and independence.
The fifth principle is education, training, and information.
Sixth principle is cooperation among cooperatives.
Seventh principle is concern for community. You can find out more information about the principles on our website, bcics.uvic.ca/radio. As well, we on the website we'll have extended versions of our interviews and supplemental information on the topics of each episode. You can look forward to next week. Ian is going to discuss the Canadian cooperative movement, how it arrived on the East Coast in the form of fishing cooperatives, how it went through Quebec and became the Caisse Populaire, or credit unions, in the form of the Desjardins credit unions, and how it arrived in B.C., and now today in B.C., 1 in 3 B.C. residents are members of credit unions as their primary financial institutions. Now we have our community bulletin.
First community bulletin is the 4th Annual International Youth Conference in Manchester. Visit bcics.uvic.ca/youthzone or visit www.coop, that's coop with a dash, .ac.uk for information on registering. Second, congratulations to Van City for being named Best Workplace in Canada according to Great Places to Work Institute Canada. Results from the survey are published in the April 10th issue of Canadian Business.
And now it's time for our random co-op trivia. This is what you've all been waiting for. A chance to win a BCICS prize package, including a BCICS publication of your choice, shipped right to your door. So, today's question is, name the largest non-governmental organization in the world. And I believe, Eric, you might have a hint or two about that?
Yes, Robin, that's correct. I think an appropriate hint might be that the institution was formed in 1895 and has the word cooperative in its name.
It sounds like a hard one.
Cooperative.
You can email your answers to bcics@uvic.ca. Please include your name and mailing address. Winners will be announced during the final week of Co-ops 101. That'll be the last week in May. All correct entries will be placed in a random draw for the prize package. And if you'd like to visit the BCICS website, you can choose which BCICS publication you would like included in your prize package.
So that's it for our episode this week on Each for All, the Cooperative Connection. Join us next week at 1 p.m. on Thursdays for more information on the cooperative movement. Please feel free to write to us at bcics@uvic.ca. if you have any comments or questions, and thank you very much for joining us.
Now we'd like to leave you with a cooperative theme tune written by Greg O'Neill and Hazel Corcoran. It's titled The Big Idea. These two people are quite active in the Canadian cooperative movement. Greg is a co-op developer in the Northwest Territories. Hazel works for the Canadian Worker Co-op Federation. And this tune was first brought to us here in Victoria during our first annual Building Cooperative Futures Conference in 2003. Greg is going to be releasing it on a new CD due out this year. Look for a link on our website. And now here it is, The Big Idea.
Marching hand in hand, every color and every nation. child, every woman and man. I see the strong ones carry the weaker. I see us sharing gifts and dreams. This song is about cooperation and the kind of world it could be. This kind of people we could be.